Tell me about making gravy.
Oh, that's easy. You just, fry some meat or have a roast and leave all those bits in there and skim off any fat. You know, you don't have to skim it all off, but just sprinkle flour. Get it off the hot stove because it's, just get it off of there, move it to the next burner, and blend that flour in with the drippings, and then slowly add either broth or milk. And that's tricky because you can put it back on the stove, but don't, it's tricky. But then it starts to thicken, and there you got it. And the easy way to make biscuits and gravy is just cook your sausage, break it all up, brown it, sprinkle flour over it, and then start adding milk. And there again, don't put it on a real hot stove, but start it up slow, and you got sausage gravy. It's real easy.
These are stories of outdoor adventure and expert advice from folks with calloused hands. I'm James Nash, and this is the Six Ranch Podcast. This episode of the Six Ranch Podcast is brought to you by DECKED. That's D-E-C-K-E-D. If you don't know what that is, DECKED is a drawer system that goes in the bed of a pickup truck or a van, and it'll fit just about any American-made pickup truck or van. It's a flat surface on top, and then underneath there are two drawers that slide out that you can put your gear in, and it's going to be completely weatherproof, so I've never had snow or rain or anything get in there. There's also a bunch of organizational features like the deco line, and there's boxes that you can put rifles or bows or tools, all different sizes. There's some bags and toolkits. There's a bunch of different stuff that you can put in there. But the biggest thing is you can take the stuff that's in your back seat out of your back seat and store it in the drawer system, and it's secure. You can put a huge payload of a couple thousand pounds on top of this deck drawer system. There's tie downs on it, so you can strap down all your coolers and your four-wheeler and whatever else you've got up there. It's good stuff. This is made out of all recycled material that's 100% manufactured in America. And if you go to decked.com/sixranch, you'll get free shipping on anything that you order. This show is possible because companies like DECKED sponsor it. And I would highly encourage you to support this American-made business and get yourself some good gear. Grandma, what would you say is a typical march?
Typical march in Wallowa County?
Yeah.
Well, unpredictable.
In what ways?
Well, it can start out like a lamb and get everybody excited about spring. You know, be a balmy day. It could be like 70 degrees down at Sheep Creek at my cabin. And in a couple hours, it can be snowing.
Yeah. That's kind of what it's been doing. It's sort of nice to have weather that is acting the way that everybody sort of remembers it, you know?
Right.
Like, this is what March should be. It's like,
right,
it's nice for a day, nice for an hour. And then it snows, and then it rains, and then it's nice, and then it blows 80 miles an hour.
Yeah. Well, the old timer said you never want to go far from your jacket in any month of the year in Wallowa County, and that's true.
Oh, yeah. That's pretty good.
Yeah.
What should people be doing in March?
Well, it depends on your occupation, what should they be doing? Well, if you want a garden, you should be thinking about that and maybe starting some plants.
What kind of garden plants do you like to start?
Tomatoes, generally. That's about it. Get the tomatoes started.
Have you done that yet?
Going to, yeah.
How many gardens will you have this year?
Oh, it's hard telling. I don't know. It depends on, you know, when you're going on 91, you're kind of, in your mind, you think you can have all that you've had in the past, but you have to, it's reality check time when you get out there with the cultivator and the stooping over and stuff.
Well, you are rotor tilling by hand still, right?
Well, yeah, when I maintain the weeds, initially
Yeah.
the garden plot is tilled by a rototiller, but to control the weeds and keep the soil friable, I prefer the little old-fashioned push tiller.
That thing is like a torture device.
You know, I've just been reading some accounts of early women in this county. Among them are your descendants, Fanny Applegate, and the things that they went through and endured, and some of those women lived to be 95. So work doesn't hurt you, and actually, I think it prolongs your life, the hardships and the physical work.
Yeah.
The thing is, you from childhood, you just keep doing it because you can't really. I see a lot of older women at 60, it's too late. You have to just, you have to have built up that, those muscles all through your life, hiking or however you do it, hard work is just, and those women proved it. Yeah, they proved it.
Now at age 90, how do you look back at 60-year-old women? Do they seem young to you?
Oh, yeah. Well, no, some of them don't, though. Some of them don't. Age-wise, 60's a child to me now. But I see 60-year-old women that look 80. You know what I mean?
Yeah, and probably not in a good way either, right?
No, and a lot of it's mental because, well, a lot of women think when they get 30 that their life is over. But I think zest for living is a very important part in, you know, your outlook on life. Yeah.
How has your outlook changed as you've gotten older?
How's it changed? Well, I just thank God every morning I'm alive and not in the obituaries. Yeah, I'm just can't wait to get up in the morning because every day is different, and I think back on my life and how it's led to coming to this beautiful place, and I have a lovely home and a good family and a sense of community. Been here 55 years, I guess. Yeah.
Let's talk about gardens a little bit more because I'm thinking about putting in a garden this year. Last year, I got my orchard going. I was out there working in it yesterday, and one of my apple trees had blown over in one of these big windstorms, year-old apple tree. But I wiggled the limbs. They feel like they're still alive. It's growing little buds. And it hadn't fallen all the way over, it just tipped over. So I've got it tied up right now, and I'm going to give it a chance. I think I've got room for three more trees in there. So I'll probably plant another apple tree, maybe another cherry tree. I've got a pear, I've got a plum, I've got a peach tree. You have any recommendations? What should my third tree be?
You have a peach, plum, apple.
Peach, plum. I've got a couple apples. I've got a pear. I've got
Well,
one cherry tree right now.
oh, one cherry tree. I was going to say pie cherries do really well. We're kind of restricted up here at this altitude, and like you say, the wind and deer. But kind of look around the neighborhood to see what survived. Apples are a mainstay, and the variety makes a big difference. But as far as a new tree, well, be brave, you know, just kind of down at the nursery, Nathan can tell you what's good, better than I can, because I know the canyons are totally different. But kind of look around at some of these old orchards and maybe get a slip of theirs. And is there something you'd like to plant that you aren't sure about?
I mean, I look at some of the stuff that they say is rated for this zone that's a little bit exotic for here, like my peach tree, you know, that's a risk. And it started to grow some little peaches last year, but then we got that frost at the end of June and it killed them. My potatoes came back after that frost a little bit. They didn't do great, but they did come back. But maybe another cherry tree. It's nice to have that early season fruit, you know, the cherries are on before anything
Do you
else.
like apricots?
I do like apricots.
Well, there's an apricot. Is it a Manchurian apricot? Anyway, it's kind of a colder climate. Nathan could help you on that, but that might work.
Yeah, that's a good idea.
It's good to be brave because down at the creek where it's lower elevation, you know, I'm originally from California and we can't have persimmons up here. And so I planted it, and we can't have quinces. So I planted a quince tree, or the people that have the magic garden at my place put one in at my request. And that thing is bearing like crazy every year now. And I think to date, I may have the only persimmon tree alive in the whole county down there. So, and
That's
it's had
interesting.
setbacks. You know, the elk and deer have eaten it.
I'm sure the
It's
bears get in there.
and the bears get in there, but it persists. It's still alive. So, yeah. And then soil makes a big difference too. You kind of need to know the acidity of the soil and for different things too. Just little things like that. But it's tough surviving up here, where you know where the winds and the winter and stuff get it through those first years.
All right. So now we're getting back to the garden. I was thinking about going just to the east of my house over here, and I was going to go ahead and build a nice tall fence around it because there are, you know, deer and elk and every other thing around. Probably the same kind of fence that I put around the orchard that worked well last year. I feel pretty confident in that height. 8 feet seems to be good enough. How big should a garden be?
As big as you have the ability to care for it.
How do you know that when you're just getting started?
Well, I don't. I always put too big of a garden in because I love to garden. And when I go to buy the seed, I can just see the pictures on the packet growing in my garden. And so I end up filling it completely full and then planting stuff too close together, and you know, it's a disease. It just gets out of hand. And so
Especially the squash.
this man that read one of my columns sent me a packet of seed with this tremendous story about the seed that was found in an earthenware pot in Arizona and carbon dated to be some thousands of years old, and cracked it open in the seed. So anyway, this man, Native American, Stub Many Goats. Have you heard this story before?
I've not heard about stub mini goats.
Well, Stub Many Goats planted it, and you have to be careful where you plant it because I mean, he had all these testimonials with pictures and everything. So anyway, I couldn't wait to plant it, and I planted it up here in Alder Slope, which my place has deep, dark loam that I've never hit the bottom of. There's an alluvial plain of it, and you can make all kinds of mistakes there and still have a garden. But anyway, back to Stub Many Goats and the seed. I planted this squash, and it. Squash. Squash. Anyway.
Usually say squash.
And so it comes up. It's very prolific. Almost every seed comes up, so you thin it. And on one occasion on Alder Slope, I planted it, and it started heading toward the cherry tree. And so I encouraged it. And then it started climbing the tree, and I encouraged it, and it went up, and it had, you know, five babies. And And you have to be careful because it climbs the fence and heads out in different directions. But the original seed were different colors. And then through the years, you know, it kind of got a life of its own, and people bought it. No, I gave it to people, and they all had stories, and it kind of reverted to a light green. But the meat is just sweet and makes better pumpkin pie than pumpkin. And anyway, I wanted to get back to the man that gave me this because this is over a 20-year period. You know, I'm still growing it, but it's an adventure.
Yeah. Okay. So
What was your question?
we're trying to figure out how big my garden's going to be.
Okay, just you up here where you are, you have a lot of rocks.
Yeah. There, the spot that I have picked out, I've got about 2 feet of really nice topsoil. And then it gets into some a little layer of clay, and then it gets down into some rock. But the topsoil that's there is pretty nice. It's also never been tilled, it's never been farmed,
Oh, good.
it's never been sprayed. It's as virgin as soil gets anywhere.
Yeah.
And it the stuff that's on top, it is that same loam that we've got on your
It's
part of the
black.
slope.
Good. Good. Yeah, you want to keep, like, in the fall, put leaves there, straw. Just keep building that humus up, you know, to hold the moisture because the nutrients in the soil will be good. Yeah. Chicken manure.
Okay. So what kinds of things should a novice gardener plant?
Well, you get instant gratification from radishes. I don't care for them all that much, but they just hardly ever fail. But just, you know, but don't plant most things until after June 1st. I don't care how great the weather is. They say when the leaves come out on the trees, you can plant your potatoes, and that is true. The old timers say that, but don't get excited about it. Ted Juvie and I talk about it. He's a master gardener. Ted is, and some of the best gardens we've planted have been as late as June 10th because the soil has to be warm, and the nights have to be warm because initially you could get that maybe in a couple days in, say, May. But then it's going to come up and you're going to get a frost and it's going to kill them. So just kind of wait till all danger of frost is past. And but corn, you know, just give it your best shot because you never know what kind of year you're going to have. But you have to be an optimist and not get discouraged.
Good to know. So squash, radishes, corn, potatoes.
What are your likes? What do you like?
I really like those purple potatoes that they grow out there on Prairie Creek.
Oh, well, that should be easy to grow.
Those things are delicious. I think they're actually a sweet potato.
Yeah, I think so too.
But I love those things. And I planted some of them last year in my orchard, and they got, you know, about twice the size of a golf ball, I guess. Before all the tops kind of came down, and that's when I dug them up. But again, they got that late frost, and I thought they were all just dead, but they did come back. Potatoes seem to be pretty tough.
When did they get the frost? In the fall or in the spring?
It was like June 24th or 25th of
Oh,
last year. You remember that?
yeah, they did. Yeah. Where'd you get your seed?
I got it from Grain Growers.
Yeah, it should be good. Certified seed, yeah.
'Cause that's a big deal. Talk me through like what people should use for potato seed and what they shouldn't and why.
You should never plant like potatoes that have gone to seed that you've bought at the grocery store. You should insist that it be certified because things like hollow heart and all kinds of diseases can come with seed that's not certified. It's really important. Grain Growers has good seed, and Nathan has good seed down there, but that's very important. And yeah.
Because those diseases stay in the ground, right?
Oh, yeah.
So once you've got it, there's
Yeah.
No getting away from it.
Yeah. And you've got virgin soil up here, so you want to keep it that way.
Sure.
Yeah, and there again, you need to kind of build up the humus in the soil. Because they raise over in Hermiston, they raise great potatoes because it's sandy almost, you know. But and you don't want to overwater them. Yeah, it's there's you get to be a good gardener by making mistakes and learning, you know, on your own. But be an optimist.
Tomatoes give people a lot of trouble. People struggle to grow tomatoes, it seems like.
Yeah, it's there's all kinds of things related to that too. Of course, if you need full sun for anything like that, and they are susceptible to frost, but if you get a short season tomato like Early Girl, they're 70 day. They usually work, but I like now to use the heirloom varieties. And sometimes some of these young gardeners will come out with a plant that has it's just gets great big juicy slicing tomatoes that we save the seeds. I have a friend and we save the seeds and plant them year after year, and oh gosh, they're good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
When we were planting a tree in your orchard and garden down there at Sheep Creek a couple years ago, you were telling me that you didn't understand why women went to the gym when they could just garden.
That's right. It uses every muscle you have, and then you eat the fruit of your labors. Yeah.
Sort of like the saying about the man who cuts firewood warms himself twice. You know,
Right.
gardens keep you healthy in more ways than just the good
Yeah.
food that comes out of it.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, you're out there breathing everything that's good in, and yeah, and it's a wonderful thing, even though sometimes it's kind of hard. There's just so much satisfaction in watching what you plant grow, and then and weeding. I love every part of it. Yeah, I've had a garden for years and years and years since I was a teenager, first married.
I think you've had at least two, if not three, gardens for decades.
Yeah, I used to help Bill George, the old fellow that lived on the slope. When he got older, I took over his garden. Then I had the one at the slope and the one on Prairie Creek. Yeah, I love gardens. My grandma that lived to be 101 or something, she was so sad when she couldn't bend over and pick a weed. That was the saddest thing in her life. And I think she was close to 100 when that happened.
Well, if that happens to you, we'll build you some garden boxes so that you can do it without having to bend
Oh,
over.
raised beds. Yeah, raised beds are nice. But
Yeah.
I love the soil. Yeah, but it's a lot of work. You don't want to let the weeds get ahead of you, because then they win.
It's pretty nice just to get down and stick your hands in the dirt.
Oh,
I
yeah.
think that people miss out on that a lot of times. They don't realize just how good that feels. I was burning some piles out here the other day and had a fire almost get away from me, and we ended up getting it caught, but I still had a bunch of wood that was burning in the middle of it, and the wind was blowing, and I didn't want the sparks to get in the grass, so I went around and kind of put it out the way I put out fires when I was fighting fire back in the day. And I remembered one of my favorite things about fighting fire was digging a hole next to some logs that were on fire, and then scooping that wet, cool dirt out of that hole, and then rubbing those logs down, and kind of how it sizzles, and just how pretty that charcoal is, and it's just, perfectly black and shimmering, and you feel the cool of the earth and the warmth of that wood, and it's just pretty special, and you don't realize it when you're, fighting fire as a young guy, but now I kind of appreciate just sticking my hands in the dirt and playing with it. It feels good.
Oh, yeah, it does. And even that dirt is so full of minerals, you know. and good dirt like we have up here. Yeah, it's all good for you. The little kids that were, I've been reading about these early day pioneers, and yeah, they're like growing things like vegetables and things in the garden. They were, because they were outside so much.
Right.
And that's, I think, was one of the secrets to their longevity.
What are some other secrets to longevity? I mean, the women, especially in our family, live for a very long time.
Yeah, we have the genetic factor both of, on both sides of yours and mine, but attitude, thankfulness and attitude and simple pleasures, like, the world's kind of going mad, but I don't dwell on that. There's not a thing I can do about it except bloom where I'm planted, but just appreciating everything, and that includes humanity, because there, in spite of what you hear, there's a lot of good people out there
Yeah.
that have desires and want to live a good life and do. And yeah, and I have faith in our youth. They say the world's going to pieces, but I said, my gosh, our young people, they didn't have to deal with all the hardships that we did. And I just think that it's in good hands. Yeah, I'm real optimistic about that.
Some hardships, if you come through them, it makes you a lot stronger.
Yep.
And others, seems like it's just a weight that you carry around
Yeah.
forever.
Yeah.
What's the real difference? Do you think it's the hardship itself, or is it how we go about dealing with it, or is it the support from the people around us?
Well, there's so many factors, and they're every individual case is different. And some things like you've been through and other people have, it's just tough. It's really tough. But I think that if you're just thankful, just concentrate on being thankful that, that you were spared and can be alive, and not let things weigh on your conscience, But does that help answer your question?
I think so.
Yeah, you have to let a lot of things go. We've had a lot of sadness in our family, and just recently lost a great grandchild, but that great grandchild left a mark, and it was a good place, and we just can't dwell on that, because life is for the living. Life is for the living. Yeah.
Something that people often get confused about, I think, especially folks who live in town, is that they think that they can live a life without animals dying to support them. And that's out here, we're very closely connected with the reality of that. Like, we know that every day there's animals that are dying so that we can live, and that's just part of the deal. Life eats life. How do you think, or how do you go about talking to folks who only live in cities that feel uncomfortable about animal agriculture, or feel uncomfortable about hunting, and maybe don't like it?
Well, I think that you have to put yourself in their shoes, and they were brought up so different than we were, and they're subjected to outside stimuli that has influenced them when they were young. But I think the more we educate, like I think your podcast does a wonderful job of that. Also, when I would shoot a cow elk or a deer or a grouse or something, I always did it with a thankful heart that, and other predators eat their own kind. Some of the male species, eat their own offspring. And so it's just a normal part of who we are and who the animal world is. And I think social media has not done that justice. I think that, I don't know, I think you just have to live by example. Mm. And I have really dear friends that don't eat meat. And that doesn't mean I don't like them or anything, but, you know, lots of times I'll cook a pot roast or something and they go, I just can't resist that. And they end up saying that was the best food they ever ate. And they change, you know. And so, but if they, some of them don't, for that's okay. But I think you just have to let it be and go on your way.
Yeah.
But you can be an example of good health, you know, amino acids for, I mean, oh gosh, your hair. Everything, you know, I used to raise cattle and sheep, and they looked like what I fed them. I fed them a good diet, you know, and it just made them glow. And we're the same way. Mm. We have to have, you know, pills can't do it. Good, fresh, wholesome, not packaged food, but real down-to-earth food is pretty hard to beat.
Yeah.
Yeah.
What's your favorite? What are some of your favorite foods?
Oh, man. Well, I love a pot roast. I like steak. I have to have meat once or twice a day. I'm sorry. And my fresh eggs. But my favorite food, I love food. I like the fresh garden vegetables. I love seafood. I love shrimp. You know, if it's really good shrimp. I don't know. I don't have a favorite food.
Yeah.
Whole milk. Everything that's supposed to be bad for you, I love. Homemade bread, yeah.
I watched a documentary on Julia Child when I was flying to Hawaii the other day. I didn't realize just what a treasure she was. Did her style of cooking... did that have any influence on you?
No, because, see, I grew up without television.
Yeah.
And but I did read Julia, and she just substantiated everything. I agreed with her completely. Butter, there's nothing like butter to cook with. And she lived a long time. Mm-hmm. And there again, it's attitude.
Yeah.
She loved life.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. And, you know, a lot of the foods that people will occasionally point at and say that's unhealthy, that's what she cooked with the most.
Yeah. Yeah, that fat is flavor. But but she also, you know, there's a wonderful thing about getting together at a table with friends. Mm-hmm. And having good food. And that's our Sheep Creek Word Herders, my writers group. There were 20 there last month, and it was just a feast, and meat is usually showcased. Mm-hmm. Because I supply it. But there's just something good about sitting down and eating a meal with people, and that goes, it's primal. It goes way back.
Yeah. Well, I'm going to give you a great big piece of this fat yellowfin tuna.
Ooh.
And then maybe you can share that with somebody or hoard it all to yourself. The thing is, they're in big blocks. They're like
oh, wow.
4 or 5 pound blocks, because these fish were just enormous.
Oh.
And once you thaw it out, you're gonna want to eat it.
Oh sure.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, how big would it be, the piece?
Oh, probably 4 or 5 pounds.
Oh, good. Well, I'll share it.
Yeah.
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 But that
can't wait.
That's a food that I've found is really satisfying. You know, salmon is a food, it's an animal, more than anything, but salmon as a meat is something that is just really, really satisfying. It never makes me feel bad to eat it. A little bit will fill you up pretty quickly. You get a lot of good energy. You sleep well. And I found that tuna is a lot the same. And the first pieces I cut off this thing, you know, I was cutting it off in sizes like what I normally eat, and I was like, man, I'm full by the time I'm 2/3 of the way through this, and I think it's just better food.
Yeah, it's rich. It's really rich and nutritious.
Mm-hmm. I think that that's an important thing for people to consider these days, is if you're eating a large quantity of something, then your body is telling you that you need a lot of it to get anything out of it. And the foods that fill you up really quickly, you need less of it, right? So
right.
The density of that quality is something that folks just don't consider very much.
Right.
But we find that with elk, we find that with good grass-fed beef, mm-hmm. With, you know, these wild fish, all that stuff. You just don't end up eating as much of it as you would of
right.
something that's a lot lower quality.
Yeah, you're satisfied. I remember, excuse me, the Basque ladies, I'd say when they worked hard and they walked miles behind those sheep, but they'd say, in the morning, if you just take a little bit of meat and eat a little bit of meat, it'll last till noon.
Mm.
And I always remembered that, you know, so lots of times if I'm really busy and have gardening and chores and stuff, I'll just take a little piece of leftover roast or something for breakfast, and it will. And just like you said, you don't have to fill your body up with a lot of fattening things.
Yeah. Yeah. So after your garden is planted and grown and you start to harvest stuff, you've got more food there than what you can eat right away. And I know you like to go around and give a lot of that produce away to people, but you also like to preserve a lot of that food. What are some of the methods you use for preserving what comes out of your garden?
Well, I make sauerkraut out of the cabbage. Cabbages do very well here. And sauerkraut can be canned or frozen. And it's wonderful. It's good for you, the probiotics. It's just good. And then I make pickles, all kinds of pickles, pickled beets, pickled cucumbers. And then I can.
Pickled green beans. I love your pickled green beans.
Yeah, I didn't get any last year. But, yeah, I love, I mean, right now, that's what I live on, is a jar of peaches or pears and little yogurt.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just wonderful to have, you know, I don't go to the grocery store too often.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then I love to give even my canned stuff away. And I know you do, too.
Mm-hmm.
You preserve a lot of food, but...
I can more meat than anything else, though. I mean, I don't have a garden yet, but I'm going to at least build the fence around it this year and maybe, you know, start with something that I feel like I can manage, put some potatoes in there and some mm-hmm. rows, and it would be fantastic to try to grow some corn. It's such a gamble here, but.
Well, as you know, it seems like I had corn clear till October mm-hmm. last year. I even had a long season corn. It depends on the year, so it's kind of a gamble, but boy, it's worth it. It's so sweet and good. And I just froze a lot of my ears. I took the silk out
mm-hmm.
and just wrapped the husk around, and I didn't blanch it or anything, just froze it. But it's kind of tricky when you go to eat it. You want to let it thaw out or cook it. Let it thaw out, and so that moisture's out, and then cook it. But it's really amazing how that'll keep.
Do you can much meat?
You know, I canned chicken. I canned, what else did I can? Venison. When I had the family, I did a lot more of that, but... not a lot of meat. No,
yeah.
I have the pressure cooker though.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I really like canned elk.
Oh man.
It's so good.
Yeah.
You know, I'll eat a jar of that once a week, if not twice a week.
Wow. And, good for you.
It's, you know, throw a little mayonnaise in there with it and some salt and pepper. And I don't ever season it, when I can it, cause I can make it taste like whatever I want once I pull it out. But if you get your mix wrong when you're canning it, you can ruin the whole great big batch.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. And you just press the meat in there and it makes its own juices too. Or do you put a little broth in?
You know, I've gone both ways. I've added just like a tablespoon or two of broth. I usually put a pinch of kosher salt in it, but that's it. Yeah, that's it. I don't know that the broth makes that much difference.
No, because you want the flavor of the natural flavor of the meat.
Right.
Yeah.
And if you're making your own broth, it's tough to get the fat out of it. And I don't really want fat in this canned elk meat. You know, there's a little bit that skims up on the top, and I just scrape that off. But that elk fat doesn't taste very good.
No. The gamey fat is hard, and it just doesn't have the flavor.
Yeah. But coming up on bear season. Bear season starts on, just here in a couple days, on Monday,
wow.
I think.
Wow.
Yeah. I'll have 2 bear tags this spring. So hopefully I can get you some. If I get an early one, might have some good fat on it for you.
Okay. My pie crust.
Yeah. What other wild game requests do you have for this year?
Oh, gosh, I'll take anything I can get because I don't hunt anymore. I love any kind of wild.
Would you like to hunt again?
Oh, I don't know. Probably not.
Yeah.
Probably not.
How come?
Well, it's physical,
mm-hmm.
you know, the way I like to hunt. I don't like to road hunt in a pickup.
Yeah.
And I remember all those times I scrunched down and crawled on my hands and knees or my belly to get a good shot, you know, and it's just physical. And I like to help with a lot of the work too. And just that was a time in my life, but
yeah.
Now I'll just take yours.
Well, that's perfectly fine. That's perfectly fine. Well, if you do decide that you want to hunt again, even if you just want to go hunting for an old white-tailed doe or something like that, you let me know and we'll figure out a way for you to do it. And you can do as much or as little of the work as you would like to.
Okay. Thank you, James. I'll remember that because I used to take you hunting when you were pretend hunting when you were about 2 or 3 years old.
Yeah. You know, people ask me all the time, you know, when I'm being interviewed for stuff, you know, when did you get into hunting? It's like you're saying, before I could talk.
Yeah, we pretended and you were really into it.
Yeah.
We'd pretend we were gutting them out, you know. That was fun. Had a tent in the living room.
Mm-hmm. And then all the times that you took me fishing out in the irrigation ditches and stuff. And it was incredible. Teaching me how to trap. That was a really, really important education. I'm grateful for everything you taught me when I was a little kid. And more than anything, it sparked an interest that I've carried my whole life and have turned into a profession now.
Yeah, I'm so happy for you because, your podcast just reflects that. And, you have a huge following.
What's the most memorable hunt you were ever on?
The most memorable hunt. Oh, I probably told you this before, but Doug and I hadn't been married too long. And we had mule deer buck tags for Amnaha, Snake River. And he had the Doug Barr Ranch then. And so the mule deer used to be just thick down there. Bucks were really plentiful. They came to the alfalfa field on the flat. And so we went to fill my tag. And we were horseback. And we were riding up a real steep canyon trail, cow trail, on horses. And I had my 243. And anyway, out of this brush patch, thorn brush thicket, exploded this buck. And he went straight uphill. And I started to get off. I got off my horse. And I just stood up and was going to shoot. And Doug said, no, you can't do that. I said, but he's leaving. I don't have time. He said, you have to get a rest and you have to do something with your horse. And I was just going crazy. So anyway, I completely disregarded everything he said, stood up and waved my gun. And he had just hit the skyline and I shot right in front of him and got him. As it turned out, right through the heart. It was a pure accident. And he came tumbling down and landed just below us in this cactus patch. And, oh, my husband was mad. Oh, he was so mad because it shouldn't have happened, and he disobeyed me. I mean, I disobeyed him. And then here was all these thorns where he had to cut to, you know, to gut it. And from the beginning to the end, it was just horrible. I was laughing. I couldn't laugh, but I was laughing inside.
Laughing on the inside.
Yeah, and then we got it on this side hill onto this, I think he had to lead his horse because he put it on there. But I was just so thrilled. That was
well, I think that's great, Grandma.
Oh, dear.
For those out there listening, we don't necessarily want to shoot at stuff that's on the skyline. That's kind of a no-no, but it turned out okay in this case, and we'll just call it a win.
Oh, dear.
I'm hunting in Texas with my friend Brandon, all of those deer are covered in cactus. You know, they just live in it, and they've got quite a bit of scar tissue on their front legs especially, and on their chest a little bit. But they're just going through that cactus all the time, and you definitely got to pay attention when you're skinning them and not just grab hold of everything because there's some pokey stuff in there.
Yeah.
Well, that's pretty great. What's your favorite wild game animal to eat?
Well, elk backstrap's pretty hard to beat.
Yeah. Yeah. How do you like to cook it?
Rare. I get cast iron frying pan hot.
Mm-hmm.
With a little butter, maybe. And then I just sear it on either side. I want to know the meat and who killed it first. But, I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. Cast iron has gotten really popular again in the past few years, which is great. You know, I think it's a tremendous tool in the kitchen and when you're camping. But, it's been interesting to sort of see people looking at old cast iron again. And then there's also some companies that are making some new cast iron that's really, really nice as well.
It doesn't have the seasoning as old ones, so.
No, it doesn't.
You have to kind of use it and know how to do it, and it imparts kind of a flavor. But you know, real old cast iron, I think there's something not medicinal but nutritious in the iron. I really do, because that's practically all I cook with. And I really like it.
Yeah. How do you take care of cast iron?
Well, they say you shouldn't wash it with soap, but, you know, I give it a good cleaning once in a while. It depends on what I've cooked, but I always keep it seasoned.
Mm-hmm.
You know, always keep the grease in it.
Yeah.
Maybe a little bacon grease to rub in it afterwards.
Okay.
But if it's seasoned really well, you can, you know, wash it with hot water and soap and it'll still be good. But it's not good to boil water in it or something acidic, but mm-hmm. you'd have to re-season it then. But it should be so that you could almost, without putting any grease in it, sear something.
Yep.
Yeah.
Yeah, like if you cook a chili or something that's got some tomato in it, that can be pretty hard on them.
Yeah, tomato's hard on
them.
Yeah. Yeah, the acid.
But the other thing I found is just you got to use it.
Yes.
The more you use them, the happier they are.
Yeah, it's like sourdough. You got to use them. And I do that most of the time. Yeah.
Have you been making any pies lately?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I kind of got in trouble. not in trouble, but kind of got out of hand. They asked me for the Healthy Futures dinner to bake donate a pie. No, not a pie. It was a It was a sourdough breakfast. Anyway, it sold for $2,900, and I still have to do it down at the creek. I have to cook it on a wood cook stove.
And you're going to make sourdough pancakes?
Yeah, wild huckleberry sourdough pancakes cooked on my old Monarch. But pies.
Let's get into that a little bit more. I don't want to gloss over this. So your old Monarch is a wood cook stove.
Yeah, it came up on a boat from Lewiston on the Snake River when Judge Tippett owned it.
So that probably would have been a steamboat.
I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know.
What year would that have been?
I don't know that either, but it was a long time ago.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Do you know what decade maybe?
I know. I saw a Monarch like this on Facebook, and it's one of the first made. It's beautiful stove. Mm. Yeah.
So how do you cook with a wood cook stove? What is that? Most people have never seen that, don't know what it is.
Well, it's something you don't just learn immediately. The main thing is you have to have the right kind of wood, the right length, and the wood that'll hold coals.
So it's got like a firebox on one side?
Yeah, the left side has a firebox, and you fill it, you know, below. But you regulate the heat by... Of course, your hottest part's going to be right where it goes up the stovepipe. But for on high, you put it there, and then you just move it to the right over the top of the oven to for simmer and everything. And it's kind of tricky, but there's nothing like that for pancakes or baking bread. And the oven also is regulated the same way. You might have to go in and turn your cake around or something to brown it next to the firebox. But the kind of wood you use, the heat of the fire, it all depends on what you're cooking. Hmm. And it's an art, and it just comes naturally the more you do it.
Yeah. So for somebody to come and have some sourdough huckleberry pancakes with you, cost $2,900.
Well, this was a high bid. It got on Oh, dear. And I'm supposed to have, pretty soon, supposed to do this because in the spring, because it heats the kitchen up too much to do it in the summer.
What's the most one of your pies has ever sold for at auction?
Oh, I can't remember. I think $600 or something like that.
Oh, more than that. I've seen most of them go for over $1,000, Grandma.
Well, I can't remember. I have one man who will just pay whatever it takes for mincemeat because I make it from elk neck, and he just comes there to buy the pie. And last year, I didn't have enough mincemeat, so I didn't make one, and he was really disappointed.
Oh, shame on me. I didn't get you enough elk neck last year?
I ran out of mincemeat, yeah.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
I failed you, Grandma. I'm sorry.
That's okay. I put out a plea to my family, but now I think next year I'll get.
You're going to be swimming in elk neck this year.
Oh,
going to have to get a freezer dedicated for it.
Oh, I don't want too much because that's work. The best way to cook an elk neck is to put it on in a big, big canner and put it on the wood cook stove and just leave it there all day till all the meat falls off the neck bones. And then the next day you grind it up, you know.
Like a pressure canner?
Well, I just have an old pressure canner bottom
okay.
that I use.
So it's not like you're putting the top
no,
on it.
No, you don't use a pressure canner. No. I guess you could, but I've always done it like this.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
I got a new pressure canner this year because we went through so much elk last year. I got a new one this year that is huge. It's like 2.5 feet tall.
Wow.
It's the biggest American-made canner that I could find.
Oh, my word.
And, you know, those batches just take forever. You know, it takes a long time to get everything cut up and put in your cans and your lids put on. And then it's got to come up to temperature, and you've got to let it steam and evacuate all the air out of there. And then you're cooking for 90 minutes, and then you've got to let it naturally come back down in temperature. So for people who are going to get into canning meat especially, I really recommend that you get just the biggest canner you possibly can. If you have a glass cooktop, you don't want to do that because you can break it. It's too much weight. But If you've got, you know, I don't really see the old coil electric ones anymore, but propane, you know, is mm-hmm. really ideal for it.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah, that's quite an art, and you appreciate the old timers, because Mary Marks told me they would take, they did it outside and had a fire, or have a wood cook stove. They'd have a summer kitchen because it would get hot down there, and they would do wash tubs with two layers of things they had to pressure cook,
mm-hmm.
and like meat. And it would just go for hours, you know,
yeah.
until it was done. But can you imagine those women now, all that work? Oh.
Who are some of the pioneer women around this area that you really admire?
Well, Mary Marks was one of them, but in the Lower Valley, they're all gone now. But there were so many. Ruth Barrymore, you know, her husband was killed in a mill accident, and she raised those little boys and kept the whole ranch together. She was amazing. The Carmans, they were just, the whole county was just full of them. There's so many I couldn't even begin to, yeah.
Do any stories stick out?
Gosh. Well, Mary, she used to spend a lot of time up in cow camp where there was no electricity. And she'd feed, well, she never knew if she was going to have 5 or 10 people, you know, depending when it was fall ride or whatever. But she could just make a meal so fast, because she would put canned goods on a pack horse and take them from down on the river up there, open up like a can of meat or something like that. And but there were a lot of stories. There was one time, though, that the riders came in and they hadn't cut her any wood, and she wasn't about to do it. So they came in, the cowboys came in for their supper, and here was, it was a crude table, and here was the axe stuck in the middle of the table. So they had to go out and cut wood, and then she cooked it.
That's a pretty stern message.
And then in my book, there was the one about the Pollywog gravy. Did you read that?
No.
Well,
I mean, I've read it, but tell
yeah,
the story.
Yeah. Anyway, so she made this gravy, and then a whole bunch of other people showed up to eat. And so she said she had to water down the gravy, and she sent one of the kids, the younger boys, out to the spring to get some water, and a bunch of pollywogs got in it. And so they just, you know, they didn't say anything. They just left them there, and she poured it in, and here were, oh, she could have killed those boys. But they were just, she cooked them in the gravy, and everybody ate them, and the boys giggled all over. She called it the Pollywog gravy.
Yeah, well, why not? Especially if you don't know.
Yeah, future frog legs.
But also, who's going to complain about the food from a gal that's sticking an axe in the middle of the table? You know, not me.
Yeah, and another time she was helping, they put fence material, well, a roll of wire on a mule and rode clear up under the rims to start, you know, where those people built fences was incredible. And just straight up and down. And her husband, Kid, said, she said, you can't take that wire up there like that. It's going to roll to the bottom. And he said, no, it's not. She said, yes, it is. So sure enough, they got up there and they unloaded it, and it rolled to the bottom, and she just rode off and left him. She said, I'm not bringing the wire back either. So that's what those women did. And they told those stories. Of course, through the years, the stories get a little different, but
better. Basically
they're the same.
Yeah, they get better.
Yeah, the meaning is still there.
Tell me about making gravy.
Oh, that's easy. You just, you know, fry some meat or have a roast and leave all those bits in there and skim off any fat. You know, you don't have to skim it all off, but just sprinkle flour. Get it off the hot stove because it's, you know, just get it off of there, move it to the next burner, and blend that flour in with the drippings, and then slowly add either broth or milk. And that's tricky because you can put it back on the stove, but don't, you know, it's tricky, but then it starts to thicken and there you got it. And, the easy way to make biscuits and gravy is, just cook your sausage, break it all up, brown it, sprinkle flour over it, and then start adding milk. And there again, don't put it on a real hot stove, but start it up slow, and you got sausage gravy. It's real easy.
I was in New Orleans last month a couple times, in and out of that tuna fishing trip, and the food in New Orleans is absolutely incredible, Grandma, if you've never been there. That French Cajun cooking, Creole cooking, it is so tasty. And I don't like spicy food. I never have. But that's the first time in my life that I've really enjoyed spicy food. And they make a lot of roux, which to me feels like a gravy in a lot of ways. You know, it's not, but it's similar. I think it's just got a little bit more oil in it probably. But it's really interesting to me how many different cultures have picked this up in various culinary forms. Like you're browning your meat, searing your meat, whatever. And then rather than just cleaning that pan out, you're going to use that as the base to create a sauce that's going to accompany the dish later. And, gosh, it was good. It was
that's
so good.
That's where all the flavor is.
Yeah.
Yeah. So what did they use for liquid in the roux? Just water?
You know, I'm not 100% sure. I haven't learned how to do that style of cooking, but I think that they're using a lot of oil. And then they're being really careful not to burn it in the same way that you're talking about with gravy. Like they'll take it to different colors based off of whatever, you know, gumbo or jambalaya or whatever they're going to be making later. But the gumbo, you know, I've only had imitations of gumbo that I never thought were good. And then having it down there, it's like, oh, this is incredible.
Oh, it must have been good.
Yeah.
What else did they put in the gumbo besides shrimp?
I don't know. It's a bit of a mystery stew for me. You know, I don't know a lot about it. I wish I knew more about how to cook that stuff. But they also like to spend all day cooking at something.
Oh, okay.
And I think that's different from the traditional pioneer style cooking around here, because you know, folks are definitely expected to be working outside of the kitchen here. And for them, it felt like, you know, somebody's going to be dedicated to watching this thing all day long.
Yeah. There's nothing like long, slow cooking for anything.
Yeah. And I love it with meat. You know, I like smoking meat for really long periods of time. And what takes a lot of people 8 hours or 12 hours, I'll spend 24 hours or 30 hours working on. And some of that is probably excessive, but I do like spending time with it.
Yeah, that's fun.
Yeah. Do you grow many herbs?
Yeah, I grow almost all my herbs and dry them.
Yeah. When you dry them, do you just hang them upside down from a string? And
I just lay them on paper towels in my kitchen in the sun until they're, you know, really dry, and then store them in jars or plastic bags. Yeah.
Okay. All right. Well, we're going to close it up with one last question. What piece of advice would you offer to our audience? I get more requests to have you on the show than anybody else. You know, I get fan mail every day. And a lot of it is, when are you going to have Grandma Janie back on the show? So there's a lot of folks all over the world that have been, you know, eager to have you return.
Oh, that's funny. So what was your question?
What piece of advice would you offer to our audience?
In what line? I mean,
anything.
Advice for what?
I mean, you're, you know, coming up on 91 years old. You've got a lot of wisdom and experience. What do you wish you knew when you were younger?
Oh, gosh, I do the same mistakes all over again. I really would, because it makes you who you are. You know, it like you say, it hones you. And I just am a great believer in, I have a strong faith. And I think our lives are all planned. And just don't sweat the big stuff or the small stuff. Just get up and go with the flow. But always be open to the positive side, you know, and have a dream and follow it. You know, what the heck?
Yeah. Why not?
And smile.
Yeah.
And eat good.
Cook with butter and be happy about
it. Yeah, sure. Have a cold beer. Nothing better than a frosty good beer, you know. Stop and smell the wildflowers. Yeah, just little things.
Awesome.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, I need to get you some tuna right now.
Okay.
And I'm going to get you some elk neck this fall.
Oh, thank you, James.
Yeah. Yeah. I'm so ashamed that I let you down on that.
Oh, no, you're okay. You make me proud. All of my grandchildren and great-grandchildren make me proud, so.
Oh, we're very proud of you. Love you very much.
They're the flowers in my bonnet.
All right. Thanks, Grandma. Uh-huh.
I just want to take a second and thank everyone who's written a review, who has sent mail, who's sent emails, who's sent messages. Your support is incredible. And I also love running into you at trade shows and events and just out on the hillside when we're hunting. I think that that's fantastic. I hope you guys keep adventuring as hard and as often as you can. Art for the Six Ranch podcast was created by John Chatelain and was digitized by Celia Harlander. Original music was written and performed by Justin Hay, and the Six Ranch podcast is now produced by Six Ranch Media. Thank you all so much for your continued support of the show, and I look forward to next week when we can bring you a brand new episode.